Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about philanthropy and race. The foundation world is largely a white world. In 2014, nearly 83% of full-time foundation staff was white. Meanwhile, the United States is set to become a majority-minority nation by the middle of this century, and many of the social problems foundations say they want to solve have a disproportionate impact on people of color. There are signs of change within philanthropic institutions. Both the Ford and the Kellogg Foundations are now led by black CEOs, and any number of foundations have made it a goal to increase diversity and inclusion. But our guests today say there is still a lot of work to do. One of those guests, social entrepreneur and philanthropy consultant Rodney Foxworth, argues that because philanthropists are so often privileged and white, their efforts lack urgency. Last week, he wrote an essay on Medium.com called "The Need for Black Rage in Philanthropy." Here's a quote. "By and large, the culture of philanthropy is academic, genteel, and composed. Last year, 344 Baltimoreans were murdered. More than 90% were black men. Half were between the ages of 18 and 30. What good is composure and politeness in this context?" End quote. In this hour, we want to pick up on Foxworth's manifesto. Is there a need for black rage in philanthropy? What would that look like? Why isn't diversity itself enough? Why aren't good intentions enough, for that matter? Rodney Foxworth is here in our studio. He is the founder of Invested Impact, a nonprofit that works with underrepresented entrepreneurs and divested communities in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having us, Sheila.
I'm glad you could come. Also with us is Erica Seth Davies, Vice President for External Affairs at the Association of Black Foundation Executives. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Rodney Foxworth, you wrote, quote, "For years, I've tried to practice a muscular empathy toward well-intentioned, privileged, and mostly white people of goodwill," close quote. What do you mean by muscular empathy?
So it's actually a quote from Ta-Nehisi Coates, also a Baltimorean, and one of our most fabulous writers on the topic of race and an intersection of politics in particular. Muscular empathy is this thought of really putting yourself into the space, the place of an individual that you just don't have the lived experience of, right? And so when I pointed this out in the piece, what I was trying to say is that my own experience as an African-American male, particularly in Baltimore City, growing up working class, oftentimes I'm in interactions with a field that is largely removed from my day-to-day lived experiences, right, in terms of the levels of privilege, in particular in philanthropy, which is dominated sort of by an elite sort of set, both in Baltimore but nationally as well. And so really it's this attempt to put myself into the shoes of those that have distinct experiences and perspective than I would potentially as an African-American with a working-class background in an urban city. And the sort of analogy to that for African-Americans, in fact, is sort of the attempt to, as I pointed out in the piece, sort of contort oneself to fit into a very privileged and white atmosphere, right? And so oftentimes the empathy is not necessarily directed back from philanthropy.
They're not trying hard enough to understand where you're coming from.
Not trying hard enough to understand where one comes from, but also in particular when you're talking about the sort of exhaustion that a lot of my peers and colleagues as individuals of color experience within the space of philanthropy. And so one of the things that was very phenomenal for me as someone who wrote the piece was I've been overwhelmed by the response from over 100 African Americans that work in philanthropy in the nonprofit sector as well, when they shared their experiences with me to say, this piece really spoke to my own experience, my own lived experience.
And I want to hear more about those reactions, but I want to take listeners who, for the most part, have not read your piece to where what you expressed sort of struck me as you snapped. There was a particular moment you describe that you just went, I can't keep doing this.
Well,
tell us about that moment.
I would say, Sheila, it's not even, I would say there was a moment of snapping. Right?
Okay.
It was sort of a constellation of experiences, particularly over the years, as someone that's worked in the field, that culminated in my sort of writing the essay was really cathartic, right? To say that, you know, here's the experience of someone that's working in philanthropy, both locally and also nationally, as an African American, that is nowhere removed from the issues of, you know, 344 murders of individuals that look exactly like me, in particular are about my age or younger. And there's a particular, you know, emotional tie to that that is often rendered invisible. And so for me, it was actually articulating a particular experience of individuals such as myself that you just don't hear it. It's not vocalized enough. We oftentimes keep it silent. And so that expression, there was no moment of snapping. I think sort of what I tried to do in the piece was acknowledge that anger from African Americans, and particularly in a place like Baltimore, is justified, right? We should be moving at urgent pace because our communities are the ones most disproportionately impacted by systemic racism, disinvestment in terms of economic development. And so, you know, there was no snapping. It's really just acknowledging this long-term history of Black anger that's actually pushed progress, both in Baltimore and in places across the country.
Okay, I wasn't trying to imply that you lashed out at somebody in a moment, but I do want listeners to understand that you framed the piece in part about a particular conversation you had with a White Foundation executive who told you basically you're pushing too fast. My trustees need more time to address what you're talking about.
Yeah, and so let me appropriately frame that. And so part of it is, I think, particularly with the response, people want to tie it down to one individual instance, right? And the reality is that this is a systemic pattern. And so, you know, it wasn't that particular one moment. That was one example that I illustrated. Mm-hmm. And so we can create, you know, we have dozens of examples on a day-to-day, right? And so it was just sort of this constellation of experiences that allowed me to develop the piece.
Erica Seth Davies, the Association of Black Foundation Executives was established in 1971. That's 45 years ago.
Yeah.
How has the picture changed?
Well, that's an interesting question. How has the picture changed? So the organization was founded actually out of protest at a Council on Foundations annual meeting in 1971. And during that time, there was very little diversity in the field. So what did exist among the leaders, the founders of APFI, was pushing the field. In and of itself, just their existence and stepping out of that that meeting that day in 1971 to say we've got to do better as a field. Over time, I think we've seen the numbers change slightly in terms of representation within the field. Most recently, we've seen some very high profile positions go to Black professionals in the field at the Ford Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation.
The CEOs there are
Black. But we've also seen a drop off at the program officer level, which is your pipeline to future leadership opportunities. We have seen a leveling of grant making dollars that are directed to Black communities and other communities of color, where that's not growing at all. As the population is growing and the needs are evolving, that the grant-making dollars aren't showing up as well. So while in some cases the diversity, the numbers, the count, the representation might be changing, in a lot of other ways there's still the same systemic issues that are happening in the field. And so that's what we work diligently to address as well.
And actually, in recent years, the numbers of Blacks working in philanthropy have crept down,
yes,
correct?
Yes, they have, unfortunately.
To what degree?
So in 2011, the Diversity in Five Initiative produced a report called State of the Work. And in it, at that time, they recorded, I believe it was 3% of CEOs were African-American and about 17% of program officers. With their most recent report released.
I'm going to interrupt you a second and ask you, some of my listeners don't know what a program officer
okay,
is. I'm
sure.
Not sure I really do. So can you tell us what a program officer
sure.
is?
Sure. Generally speaking, within foundations, program officers are the people who are in touch with grantees, are reviewing proposals, making recommendations within their organization on who should be funded and who won't be funded. Very often they are aligning with the overall strategy strategy of the foundation to ensure that the grant-making dollars that they're approving, are furthering the goals of those strategies within the foundation. So that is your front line within a foundation.
And you said a few years ago?
It was 17% African-American.
And
it's 12% most recently. So we've seen a drop-off.
Why do you think that is?
At APFI, actually, several years ago, we saw a slight decline from 17 to 16%. And although it may have been a blip, and now we know that it may not have been, we commissioned a report called The Exit Interview, Why Black Professionals Leave the Field of Philanthropy, because we noticed in cities, and it was mostly anecdotal, but we noticed that people weren't at the foundations that they were working at the year before. But what they weren't doing was transitioning to another foundation. They were leaving the field entirely. And so that actually was a troubling trend for us. And we commissioned this report, interviewed over 215 current and former professionals in the field, and came away with a number of findings as to why Black professionals are leaving the field. First and foremost, they don't feel that they have opportunities to leadership, that there aren't very clear pathways or pipelines to leadership positions within the field. Also, we learned that a lot of professionals, they move into positions where they feel that they can influence their communities, influence outcomes in their communities. I think a lot of people get into philanthropy just across the board because they want to make a difference. They want to do something to get resources. And it's not always just money, but how can we get resources to communities and to issues that are in need? And Black professionals don't feel that that's possible very often from their positions once they get inside of philanthropy. So they shift into positions where they feel that they can be more engaged in the communities that they care about. One of the findings was that a lot of professionals feel that they're in a culture that actually starts to nudge them out. Through microaggressions, again, lack of opportunity within institutions, that there's not a real chance for meaningful leadership, and that they feel encouraged, actually, to pursue other avenues outside of philanthropy, that there's a much greater need for them to defend their portfolios and the decisions that they make around their grants, and that gets exhausting. It gets exhausting after a while.
So, Rodney Foxworth, you're nodding your head as you're listening to Erica Seth Davies go through these reasons people leave. It resonates with you.
It certainly does. And the reality is that, again, the response from my particular essay and the conversations I had with so many African Americans in particular leading up to writing it bears it out, right? That sort of experience that we don't speak to is so common, right? Whether it's African-American women, Black males, and other underrepresented individuals, the sort of dance that one has to do to fit into a particular culture, Erica said, feeling that you're getting nudged out, even getting into the door is oftentimes very difficult, right? So even once you're in, it could oftentimes be a very exhausting experience, and it's something that we just don't speak to. And so again, between the individuals that reached out to me after the essay that really spoke to their own lived experience as both grant makers, some of them were program officers themselves working within foundations, speaking to their own experience about the exhaustion of trying to leverage resources to the communities that they want to invest resources into, and operating within institutions that were not necessarily built out for that sort of resourcing, to connect those types of resources financially, human capital-wise, to majority African-American communities. So that was something, and continues to be something that's profoundly impactful for me, is it validated not only my own experience, but the fact that it was affirmed by so many others that are not only attempting to get resources from philanthropic institutions, but are in fact embedded inside of them themselves.
We need to take a quick break here. And when we come back, there's much more I want to ask you about philanthropy and race. And listeners, you are welcome to join this conversation. Are you involved in philanthropy? Do you agree that foundations tend to lack a sense of urgency about problems in Black communities, you can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about philanthropic institutions and whether their lack of diversity means they're too complacent when it comes to problems affecting minority communities. My guests are social entrepreneur and philanthropy consultant Rodney Foxworth and Erica Seth Davies, Vice President for External Affairs at the Association of Black Foundation Executives. You're welcome to join this conversation. Are you an African American who works in philanthropy? Do you feel isolated? Are you listening to Rodney Foxworth describe the reaction he's gotten to his piece, The Need for Black Rage in Philanthropy, and thinking, yeah, I think that way too? If so, send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Erica Seth Davies, do you think that philanthropy is slower than business to move toward diversity? And if so, why?
I think so. And I think the reason why is that in business, there are other forces, market forces very often, that can drive change. So whether it's a consumer base, whether it's a board of directors or investors, there are some external factors or forces that can encourage a much faster pace of change in business. Whereas in philanthropy, that's not always the case. With community foundations, for example, which is where I actually tend to see quite a bit of diversity on the boards and on staff, they do have a donor base, and they are responding to needs within a particular geographic area. So there's a different level of accountability. But with private and family foundations, that same external pressure doesn't necessarily exist. So it makes it a little bit more difficult, I think, to encourage change in a particular way or to see it move at a particular pace, a faster pace.
Rodney Foxworth, some people may be listening to this and hearing you describe, I think contort is the verb you've used about the way you feel you have to try to relate to people who are in charge of money in these institutions, in foundations and other institutions. And people might say, well, these are people sitting on piles of money. Everybody has to suck up to them. Excuse my language. That is kind of the nature of the beast, that it may be frustrating and it's not surprising you're frustrated, but that's the game.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I want to point out one thing that Erica pointed out earlier. And so I'm of the opinion that most everyone, if not everyone in philanthropy, is doing the work because they are driven to do good, mm-hmm. right? They want to see a positive outcome and impact, and quite frankly, have met a number of strong relationships with individuals in philanthropy. So I want to point out that and lift that up, because there are a number of individuals that are working diligently to make places like Baltimore City as strong as they can be. Now, to your point about the game, and this is something I wrote about in the piece, I'm sort of questioning and interrogating the rules of the game, right? And so when we talk about diversity, particularly in a place like Baltimore, what I'm really speaking to is not a question of diversity. I'm talking about representation, right? And so we have a city that is 64% African-American, and so many of the concerns and issues that we're trying to solve are disproportionately in these communities. And yet, we don't have individuals from those communities helping to determine and shape where resources go. And the reason why this is important, and I understand the point of you have to sell, you have to play the game. However, what people don't acknowledge, particularly those that are not of color don't acknowledge, is the fact that that is in itself a sort of an oppressive act, right? And so individuals of color that have to constantly sort of define and really align the interests of the majority African-American community to individuals that might be removed from it is in itself a very exhausting activity that constantly happens. And so we don't have a framework for really analyzing the toll that it takes on individuals that are placed within these institutions, whether they're working within philanthropy or themselves are individuals trying to get resources. And so that's a really important point, because in a city like Baltimore City, we're talking about majority African-American communities. And you look at the numbers, which, by the way, and this is why Erica's work is so important at APFI, and APFI is such a essential institution, is we don't really call out what the data is, right? And so it's curious, and this is where some frustration comes from not just myself, but again, from many that work in the field. It's quite curious when the question of diversity comes up when we're not really talking about representation. So why does it look like in a city like Baltimore City, 64% African-American, and we don't have individuals from at least similar communities as those in Baltimore City really helping to shape and drive sort of the decision-making from a governance perspective, but then also from a direct day-to-day perspective as well. And I think that's incredibly important for people to understand, is that we're talking about a context in which African-Americans are disproportionately attempting to sell or convince individuals that might not be very wedded or vested into the communities in which those particular African-Americans are coming from, right?
I might even take that a step farther and talk about the networks that are necessary mm-hmm. to even access some of the foundations in Baltimore. There are a number of foundations that don't even accept applications. So the opportunity to even put yourself in front of them is limited.
To make a proposal.
To make a proposal mm-hmm. That they only give to pre-selected organizations. So thinking about the networks that exist around an entity like that, where you either have to know a board member or if there is staff, that you have to know someone on staff to be able to surface on the radar of one of those organizations presents a challenge as well, a significant challenge. When there is an open application process, again, the representation that's not there in a lot of foundations, I think it matters. It matters significantly when approaching the organization, when having to think through five steps. Okay, how do I explain X, Y, and Z that's relevant to my community that may not directly fit into this bucket that this foundation is funding, but it is having an impact on the outcome that they want to achieve. So all of these things come into play. And again, as Rodney was saying, the lack of representation in that circumstance, it matters.
That is Erica Seth Davies here on Midday on WIPR. She's Vice President for External Affairs at the Association of Black Foundation Executives. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me in the studio is social entrepreneur and philanthropy consultant Rodney Foxworth. And we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 or your emails at midday@wypr.org. I'd like to pull Adar Ayira into the conversation. She is a director of programs at Associated Black Charities. Adar, it's nice to hear you.
Thank you so much for taking my call. And Rodney and Erica, hi, how are you? So I so totally agree with what they both have raised, especially their discussion about the lack of representation, the lack of access, and the lack of opportunity. And the lack of representation, access, and opportunity is so important because it speaks to a cultural mindset that is in philanthropy. And let me bring up this point. What we are really talking about in this conversation is, for lack of a better phrase, white philanthropy, because every community has a different history of philanthropy. And we never talk about that. We only talk about philanthropy the way that it is represented in mainstream, the philanthropy with the multimillion dollars of assets. But as Rodney was saying, it also means that people are very myopic sometimes within their perspectives without the context of other philosophical perspectives or experiences. And oftentimes in philanthropy, we engage people of color who are only assimilated into the mainstream philanthropic cultures, rather than reaching out to other people of color and using them for their expertise, for what they bring with ideas, with strategies to solve their own problems. People who know all of that, but who just need resources to do so. And Erica also spoke about the lack of opportunity for people to even gain access. And that's why Associated Black Charities has, and for many years has had, a board pipeline professional development leadership project where we train professionals who are from groups who are racially underrepresented on boards. The program is not exclusionary of white people, but what we understand is that the majority of people represented on boards in nonprofit organizations are white. And again, this is about expanding opportunity so that we can expand the cultural representation and experiential mindsets to those who are not represented on these boards or in these fields. So we connect our board pipeline professionals to nonprofit organizations that are looking not only to diversify, but to expand the lens with which they are looking to solve and to help solve some of the challenges of Baltimore.
Well, I want all of you are making points that lead me to a point that you made in talking to our producer, Andrea Appleton, that at some level, philanthropy, at least big philanthropy, is based on inequality. We're talking about individuals, families, corporations that accumulated so much wealth that they can give lots of it away, or that actually they may be financially better off because of giving it away. So is it inherent in that kind of enterprise that it's going to preserve a system as it exists, and it's not going to be looking for disruptors?
I don't think it has to be. And right. So there are models across the country that really point this out. Think about something like resource generation, which is a sort of a network of majority white and privileged younger individuals, millennials, Generation X, that have acknowledged their privilege, and how can they leverage their privilege, particularly financially, to invest in movement building in black communities, for example, right? And so there are actually models and places where you don't necessarily have to have the sort of culture that we oftentimes see, as Adar pointed out, you know, white philanthropy, institutional philanthropy, you know, family foundations in this sort of institutionalized manner. There are tons of examples that you can point to. But I do think that one of the struggles of it is that there's very rarely an opportunity to critique the institution of philanthropy to begin with. Mm-hmm. So even having this conversation is very rare. So I just wanted to add that as well.
It's rare. Is it also risky? I mean, in having this conversation and on the public airwaves, thank you for coming, but do you risk turning off donors?
Well, for AbbVie, I think people who come into our universe know exactly what they're getting. We exist to promote effective and responsive philanthropy in Black communities. We encourage grant making through a racial equity lens. We offer support to foundations through training and technical assistance to help them turn that lens on their own operations. So whether it's hiring, grant making, investment management, there are all these ways in which foundations can operate differently if they're serious about adhering to their values. When those values state, we seek a more just and equitable society in any issue or on any level. So it's partly a willingness to do that work. But again, for our organization, it's what we do. So it's not inherently risky for us to talk about it, but I absolutely understand. And we provide safe space for individuals for whom it is risky. people who within their own organizations don't feel that they have the room to speak to these issues. Rodney mentioned in his essay a moment when that we held space for our members the day after the murder of Philando Castile. We just put out a call and said, if you want to have 15 minutes, just take a moment to breathe, because we know everyone is feeling this. Just dial in. We didn't have a whole lot of speaking, a whole lot of engagement, but we had over 100 people call in to a line just to know that their grief, their rage, what they were feeling was completely valid. We understood, and we were giving them a space to feel it. So that's what we do as an organization. And as risky as it is, and it has been, I think, at times, we feel it's the work that needs to be done just to continue to move that agenda, an equity agenda within the field.
Dar Ayura from Associated Black Charities, I'm going to need to let you go in a minute when we take another break, and I want to give you a chance to it seems to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you're sort of in a parallel situation with Erica Seth Davies. She talked about being in an organization that exists to serve Black Foundation executives, and therefore there's some freedom to articulate things and to have conversations that perhaps other people in the world of philanthropy don't have. In a way, I think of Associated Black Charities as similar in the sense that you, for example, have the only Black CEO of a foundation in the Baltimore region. Does that put a particular obligation on you, or does it just make it somewhat simpler or not?
It doesn't make it simpler, and in fact, we take incredible risk. We also have some support, but we operate within the same power dynamics as any other organization in the rest of the country. And because we are Black-led, there are things that when we say it, it is going to be taken differently than if a white person says it. And the philanthropic community is afraid in large part of these discussions. And I think that they're afraid, knowing that what they want to do is good work, they're afraid of being blamed. They're afraid of fingers being pointed back at them. They're afraid of this conversation for all of the reasons that people are afraid to discuss race. However, like Erica and like Rodney, at Associated Black Charities, we do believe that the conversation is about enhancing the effectiveness of philanthropy and enhancing it in a way that provides opportunity for more communities to problem solve, to gain resources. It is not about finger pointing or blame, but the conversation is conversation that desperately needs to happen regardless of the risk. And that's why we continue to take the risk every day.
Dar Ayura, I appreciate your calling in. Thank you so much.
And thank you. Thank you for allowing me to call.
Dar Ayura is Director of Programs at Associated Black Charities. We are going to take a quick break here. Rodney Foxworth and Erica Seth Davies are going to stay with us as we discuss the need for Black rage in philanthropy, the title of the essay that Rodney Foxworth posted last week. You can be part of this conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or a phone call to 410-662-8780. Rodney Foxworth says philanthropy is one of the last acceptable enclaves of white privilege. How does this strike you? Give us a call or send us an email. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, my guests today are social entrepreneur and philanthropy consultant Rodney Foxworth and Erica Seth Davies, Vice President for External Affairs at the Association of Black Foundation Executives. We're talking about an essay Rodney Foxworth recently wrote for Medium.com titled The Need for Black Rage in Philanthropy. And Rodney, I want to get back to a point we were talking about earlier, which sort of stems from one of the things you wrote in your essay, quote, "What if foundation boards in communities like Baltimore were governed by individuals directly impacted by structural racism and economic disinvestment, end quote. Is that happening anywhere, to your knowledge? Is there a place to point to that has made some progress in that?
I think there are certainly steps that are being made in Baltimore. But we don't, I think it's really difficult in terms of if we're talking about the mainstream philanthropic institutions, both in Baltimore and across the country, I would say that we don't have the real meaningful examples that we need to see. I think that there are individuals and institutions attempting to become more representative. But it also speaks back to the question or the sort of development of most of institutional philanthropy, particularly when it comes to family foundations, right, in which more than likely you're going to have members of the family in perpetuity or individuals that are closely connected to the family. And that speaks back to, you know, in a place like Baltimore, which is hyper-segregated, mm-hmm. just generally, it manifests itself particularly in a really acute way in philanthropy. And so it's really difficult to sort of have the access in terms of the governance question. And so I think there, if we were to really extend ourselves in our imagination and think about what we're really attempting to do, particularly in a place like Baltimore. And I think about this, and to your earlier question, you asked about risk. And my perspective on it is that there's an inherent risk in continuing to do things the same way in the traditional manner. And so to my colleagues and peers in philanthropy, all of them are motivated to do the right thing and to create something good in the city of Baltimore, right? And yet there's still the conversation that we haven't acknowledged of that, you know, without equity, without really investing into the leadership that's embedded directly in Baltimore's communities, you're likely not going to see the change that you want to see. And that's a different conversation. That's a conversation that, you know, AFI's been carrying. That's a conversation for a long time. Associated Black Charities has carried. But it's something that we have to really think about and actually design solutions for. We need to have investment directly tied to African-American leaders across the city and the communities. And even for an organization like ABC, the reality
is Associated Black Charities.
The reality is, you know, Diane Bell McCoy, the CEO of that organization, is the single, you know, African-American leadership of an organization of its type. However, when we're talking about this, when we have a conversation about mainstream philanthropic institutions, Associated Black Charities is a public charity, which means that they're raising money to fulfill their mission, which is inherently a different sort of power dynamic even for Associated Black Charities. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the landscape in Baltimore City in terms of the power and privilege embedded into traditional
private philanthropy.
It's a different conversation, right? Because ABC, Associated Black Charities, consistently has to raise resources to meet its mission rather than have an endowed foundation, which is a completely different conversation. And it speaks to the lack of representation in the Baltimore philanthropic community.
And Baltimore, there are no other Black CEOs of philanthropic organizations, of foundations in Baltimore, or senior level executives of organizations in Baltimore. And I believe just a handful of program officers, literally a handful of program officers in Baltimore, in a city that is 63-64% Black, that should raise some eyebrows.
Let's talk to Devin, who has called us from Baltimore. Devin, welcome to Midday.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Primarily, I'm listening, and this entire topic resonates with me greatly because I'm a person that is from Baltimore City, born and raised from the East Side, from where I call Hopkins Shadow. There's names for my neighborhoods now, but I've grown up here and I've watched the neighborhoods change. What I find so frustrating is that as a person who's from here, who has the desire to do great things and make the neighborhoods the way that they used to be, it seems like there are so many roadblocks for me and other people that live around me who just want to make our neighborhoods better.
And when you say so many roadblocks, tell me briefly about one.
primarily, to be quite honest, I noticed that a lot of organizations that are nonprofit organizations that want to do great things to give back to all the underrepresented, all the underprivileged, quote-unquote, people of color within the community, they're headed or run by white people. And that's fine. I'm not a racist person, but it would be great if we had more representation within those organizations, or if we had more organizations run by people who are from here.
Devin, I appreciate your calling. I'm jumping to the conclusion that you both agree with Devin, but what would you say to build on what she just told
us?
Well,
and she brings up such a great point, and it's one about the data. So we were just talking about the data around representation within foundations. The next level around that is data around the nonprofits that are actually serving communities, and then connecting those two, right? Connecting resources with the communities and who's serving those communities. I'm not sure that too many foundations, Baltimore-based foundations, are collecting data on their grantees either to know, for good or bad, how they are allocating dollars in Black communities in Baltimore or in the growing Latino and Hispanic community in Baltimore. So when grantees submit applications or once they are approved before those dollars are allocated, do we know what the leadership, the staff leadership, the board leadership, and the target population for services, do we know what that balance looks like as well, in addition to the composition of the foundations themselves? Because that gets to her point around it's great that these, you know, nonprofits are moving into our communities to try to serve us, but we also want to know that people who look like us, who share our experience, are doing that work as well and can be successful in doing that work as well.
Well, do we have data that would let you tell me, okay, I'm sorry that you're frustrated, and that's not a minor thing, but even if you're frustrated, is the grant money still going to projects in these neighborhoods? Is work still being done? I think what you just said, Erica, is that you couldn't answer that question. There isn't the data.
The data exists. I don't know that it's being analyzed that way. So, for example, you can go to a 990 form for any foundation.
A 990
foundation.
is the IRS form. The form that gets filed with the IRS.
That's
by
right.
A nonprofit.
And foundations are required to list out their grant-making organizations and the dollars that are allocated each year. So you could go and do the analysis of that if anyone was willing to do that. It's mm-hmm. a time-consuming project, but something that could be done. Or the foundations themselves could collect that data once they are receiving either applications or before they're approving grants to go out the door. So it's out there in the universe, but has it been collected, analyzed, synthesized, and then produced as a, hey, these are the number of dollars going to this community geographically, and then here's the composition of those nonprofits in those communities? That hasn't happened. And that's where I believe she's getting to. That's where Devin was going with her her statements around where resources are in those communities.
Let's talk to Derek, who's called us from Pasadena. Derek, welcome to Midday.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay, you know, three things, and I'll make them quick. One, basically the problem with philanthropies is that they see people of color more or less as a bad investment. But putting the money there or in the leadership hands isn't going to yield the results. I try to connect nonprofits run by people of color to philanthropies. And what I have to keep re-explaining to the philanthropies is, you know, if you believe in what the mission, just put the money on the table and walk away. Because you don't have such a disconnect when people are willing to play by the rules that the philanthropy sets in order to get the money. But when you really want to do good in the community, I tell philanthropies, just do it without condition and just trust that the money is going to be used the right way. And you will either see that it has or it has not been. But bridging that gap is proving to be difficult.
Derek, that's a powerful thought. I appreciate your putting it on the table. It kind of runs against everything I've always been told when I serve on boards, that we need to keep track of a foundation, a philanthropy needs to make sure that it's investing money wisely, that when it funds some activity that it works, or if it doesn't work, there's a way to make it better. Derek seems to be saying, just there's a wisdom in crowds. Trust the community.
And it's not just Derek. And I think that's sort of the overwhelming response in terms of the essay itself that I've received, right? And I think this goes back to the relationships that are, have to be developed to create the access for the types of individuals that Dark's talking about, or for Devin herself. And the reality is, you know, when you start looking at the grant dollars awarded to African Americans in Baltimore City, or donations, charitable contributions from mainstream, you know, foundations, philanthropic private institutions, the data that we've been trying to find is pretty bad. It's really stark. In a community, in a city that's 63% African American, you're rarely going to see many African Americans receiving the philanthropic investment that is out, that is available. And what's interesting, the one thing that's popped up in a series of conversations, both after the essay was published and before, and the question I receive a lot has been, you know, are there enough African American leaders to do the work? That's actually been one of the questions. And the reality is, when I think about this, the question is only asked by my white peers and colleagues. Mm-hmm. That question is never asked, or very rarely asked, by, you know, African Americans in the work. And in fact, when I pose that question, when I mention this, it's almost met with laughter, dismissive laughter by African Americans, not because, you know, it's humorous, but actually it's a pain point that there's not a recognition that there's 100 Devins in Baltimore City, right? There are hundreds of individuals that are doing the work, under-resourced, and are not able to get access to the kind of opportunities that philanthropy can provide. And I do want to make the point that philanthropy in and of itself is only one leg of the stool, obviously. I have the personal belief, and many others do, that it is one of the rare instances where there can be opportunities to invest in a way that will engender equity and inclusion. And also, when you're not quite sure what the outcome will be, you can take a chance. Mm-hmm. It's the one place where you really can take a chance and invest. And I think that's sort of the one of the roles of philanthropy that we don't really think about. And when Derek's talking about the question of not feeling that African Americans leaders can have the same impact, that's sort of related.
That has to be our last point. I'm grateful to you both for this hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Erica Seth Davies, Vice President for External Affairs at the Association of Black Foundation Executives, and Rodney Foxworth, founder of Invested Impact, a nonprofit that works with underrepresented entrepreneurs and disinvested communities in Baltimore. His essay, The Need for Black Rage in Philanthropy, we'll have a link to it on our website. Also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Full Service Market, with locations on North Charles Street and Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Unique sandwiches, salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the low oxygen area in the Bay, the dead zone. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.